This is Ian Punnett on second Sunday of every month now. John B. Wells taking over permanently on Saturday night. We had him on in the first hour. Really enjoyed that chat. If you missed it and you've got Coast Insider, you can go back and listen to it anytime. If you don't have Coast Insider, why don't you? It just gives your life so much flexibility. You never have to miss a minute of Coast to Coast during the week with George Norrie or George Knapp or whoever is on. And at coasttocoastam.com, you can get more details about signing up for Coast Insider for the new year. And at coasttocoastam.com, you can also link up to the work of Dr. Roger Rootes. We're going to talk about the fully informed jury movement and a couple of fascinating tangents from that, which you all have fully informed me of. Like I said, this was originally a tip-off from somebody who tweeted it to me, at Deacon Punnett. And thank you again for staying in touch during the week. Enjoy this very much. And you are never going to think the same way about the Fourth Amendment next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, as any of you know who listen to Coast AM regularly, I am a freedom advocate. I'm a big believer in liberty. Liberty to me means choice all the time. And it also means that we are the people. The government serves us, not the other way around. And we have a responsibility to prevent government from overreaching into our lives. Not to say that there shouldn't be law enforcement or that laws or the people who enforce them are the enemy. But we have to hold that in tension with our freedoms as guaranteed by the Constitution. The Fourth Amendment to the United States is the one that pertains against in regard to unreasonable searches and seizures, requiring any warrant to be judicially sanctioned and supported by probable cause. There's more to it than that, however, and that's where Dr. Roger Rootes comes in. He is a criminologist, a legal scholar, and an activist for our civil liberties. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com, which is something I would highly recommend you do to find out more about his work. Good evening, Dr. Rootes.
Good evening, Ian.
Thank you for making time for us on such short notice, and I'm grateful to hear that you are already a fan of this show and know full well what Coast to Coast is about.
Oh, yes. Listen, I've listened to it many times, especially to George, of course, during weeknights, but yeah. I haven't listened to you before.
Well, I'm glad George deserves that, and I'm glad to have you listen whenever I can. You are a lawyer as well as a PhD. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I practice law mostly today in the federal appellate courts, mostly working on some cases in the U.S. 8th Circuit Court of Appeals and the U.S. 9th Circuit Court of Appeals right now.
And you live in Montana?
Yes.
Okay. You can find out more about this movement by going to our website and go from here. But let's lay the groundwork for people who don't even understand the difference between a regular trial by jury and a trial by a fully informed jury.
Yeah, well, that is one of the central problems of our time, is that very issue. Today, you know, it's funny that, you know, I am on the board of advisors of something called the Fully Informed Jury Association, which is also based in Montana, based in Helena, Montana. And the Fully Informed Jury Association, you can find their website at www.fija.org, F-I-J-A.org. And their basic mission is to educate jurors. And a lot of people wonder, well, what are you talking about? Why would, you know, why do jurors need to be educated? The problem in most modern criminal courtrooms today is that jurors are misinformed. In fact, they're actually misinstructed and they're lied to. They're actually deceived by the judges, ironically. What happens is that over time, the juror's proper role has been diminished, and judges today in a lot of courtrooms are in the practice of falsely telling jurors that the jurors can only judge the facts, that they are mere fact finders, and that they are not allowed to judge the law or to think about the law or to think about the constitutionality of a law that's at issue in a trial, or to think about the justice of the prosecution or any of those questions. Keep in mind that the founding fathers placed the right to trial by jury in the Constitution three times. It's one of the only, you should say, protections that appears in the U.S. Constitution three different times, actually four times, if you count the grand jury clause of the Fifth Amendment. The founding fathers regarded trial by jury as one of the most important protections of the American people. You know, probably more important than any other right that they might have. But what happens today in a lot of criminal courtrooms is that the judge falsely tells the jury that, for example, if the government meets its burden of proof in a criminal case, that they are somehow required to convict, and that is absolutely not true.
I want to jump in for one second because you've brought up so many issues along the way, and I want to go back and just pick at one thing, because you said that juries are fact finders, but I think when you're also talking about it, you make it sound more like they're just merely fact adjudicators. They're not there to find facts per se. They can't generally ask questions. They can't find new facts that aren't presented to them. And if the defense attorney or the prosecutor hasn't presented that fact, the jury is not empowered to go out and find out any facts on their own.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Well, I want to say that because I think the point you're making is actually broader than that, that they are there to then, that properly, they can be more engaged in properly instructed. They should be more engaged in the finding of facts, of what is a fact.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question in itself. Yeah, there are, you know, judges try to separate issues in a trial into two different categories, issues of law and issues of fact. And the precise line between those is actually quite difficult to discern in
yeah.
cases. Members of the U.S. Supreme Court actually disagree with each other sometimes about just what is an issue of law and what is an issue of fact. Basically, the founding fathers viewed the jury as a check on government, and that is its most important role and its most important purpose and function.
And that's not always how that gets lived out, is it?
Well, not at all. In fact, they're actually deceived in practice today. You know, most of us are aware that if the government fails to meet its burden of proof in a criminal case, the jury is required to acquit. They are required to find the defendant not guilty. Okay. What if the government meets its burden of proof? Is the jury required to convict? The answer is absolutely not. And that is the crux of the point of the Fully Informed Jury Association. The jury is never required to convict, never. It is always within their power to acquit any defendant, no matter how, let's just say, insurmountable the proof of guilt is, no matter whether the government meets its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, no matter what the evidence is, or no matter what the facts are. The jury has the power, for example, if they view that a statute is unconstitutional, even though the judge tells them that the statute is constitutional, the jury has the power to declare a defendant not guilty. And you know, this is an issue that has sort of raged Anglo-American law all the way back to the Magna Carta, really.
Sure.
All the way back into the common law of England. There have been controversies on this very topic.
You know, I think we can think of a couple of well-known cases, maybe some of them even just from popular fiction with some movies or from books, where a jury has decided that somebody is innocent based on the facts or guilty, and then we see a judge coming in at the end of the trial and basically saying, you all weren't paying any attention, or there's nothing here that can support your conclusion. Is that just fiction, or does that happen where a judge will reverse the finding of a jury that has given it full thought and just decided this is our verdict, and a judge merely throws out that verdict and says, no, this is wrong, we got to start again?
Well, it happens a lot in civil cases where judges often set aside a verdict of a jury. In criminal cases, there are a lot more, let's just say, constitutional implications.
Right.
There's the Double Jeopardy Clause. The Double Jeopardy Clause means basically that any properly instructed jury that acquits a defendant means that the government can never again try that defendant for the same offense. So the jury has it in its power to stop the government's proceedings against a member of their community, even if, in the eyes of the government, a case is so strong that no reasonable jury could have acquitted. So, there is a clash. Often a judge views the evidence different than the jury. Keep in mind that a wrongful conviction by the jury can trigger all kinds of appellate protections, protections on appeal. Okay.
Right, but
I'm sorry.
No, no, please go ahead.
But many judges view an acquittal sometimes to be a wrongful acquittal. And you see over time there have been many famous cases where judges tried to either intimidate a jury into convicting or even to try to punish a jury after acquitting. And, of course, there's very strong case law on the books, actually for hundreds of years, which requires that no juror can ever be punished. Although what's funny is you see in a lot of modern courtrooms, there's a lot of intimidation that goes on. The judge is often in practice in a lot of courtrooms of intimidating the jurors, in my opinion. I was recently in a federal courthouse, and I just saw a federal judge 5 or 6 or 7 times just telling a jury, you understand that you are you must follow my instructions on the law, and that it is a violation of your oath if you fail to follow my instructions on the law. Of course, that's absolutely a lie. It's absolutely dishonest, and it's deceptive, because the judge knows it's not true. The judge knows that no juror can ever be punished for his verdict. And so you see those kinds of false instructions going on all over the place in federal criminal practice.
Doesn't that open the door then for an immediate appeal? Or do judges, is there, if you'll pardon the borrowing an expression, like a black wall of silence, calling off the judge's robes, where that one judge will back the other judge will back the other judge when it comes to judicial overreach?
This issue is funny. Part of the long-term goal of our cause, Fully Informed Jury Association and all of the jury rights advocates, is to overturn the regime of false and deceptive jury instruction that exists right now in criminal cases. Going back into back through the pages of history, there's been a series of, let's just say, close cases and split decisions among state and federal appellate courts. And there was a case in 1895 called the Sparf and Hansen versus United States decision that sort of the winning plurality went against liberty. It upheld the kind of deceptive instructions that we see today. And so it's very difficult today. Sometimes you'll see defense attorneys trying to tell jurors, hey, this statute's unconstitutional, or my God, this is an unfair prosecution, or something like this. And you'll see that judges will sometimes threaten and coerce and intimidate, sometimes even hold lawyers and defendants in contempt for trying to inform the jury of the rights that the jurors have.
That thought, the rights that the jurors have, even that, if you don't mind me saying, again, we're talking with Dr. Roger Roots, criminologist, attorney, and advocate for civil liberties, especially when it comes to the fully informed jury movement, that idea of jury rights, that in and of itself, I think, is kind of a concept for a lot of people, that we have the right only to do what the judge tells us to do, and that there is no place where a jury's rights are spelled out that supersede whatever the judge tells the jury, right? I mean, there is no place where a juror can say, oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor, but that's not actually constitutional. And what happens if a juror dares do that?
Well, here's what's funny is the judge that tells a juror that they are somehow violating their oath or something as a juror if they dare to disagree with the judge's interpretation of the Constitution or the laws, it is a knowing deception and a dishonesty because the judge knows that there can be no punishment. There's a case from 1670 in England. It actually stemmed from the William Penn trial, a very famous trial. You know, William Penn, of course, a famous person who later on in life, he came to the New World and founded what is now Pennsylvania. But before he came to what is now Pennsylvania, William Penn was a Quaker minister in England as a younger man, and he gave a Quaker sermon on the streets of London. As I recall the story, keep in mind that there was only one official religion at that time, and that was the Church of England.
Right.
And they had actually padlocked his Quaker church, so he couldn't actually get into his own church on Sunday morning.
Isn't that funny?
He turned around and held a Quaker sermon in the streets of London. And he was prosecuted. He was arrested and charged. He was prosecuted for, I believe the offense was called unlawful assembly. And at his trial, the judges, it was a panel of judges at that time, actually, told the jurors, you know, that you can only consider the facts, not the law. You can only consider the facts. Did William Penn preach on the street, or did he not preach on the street? Amongst did he create an unlawful assembly? And of course, you listen. There were hundreds of witnesses. There was no doubt of his quote guilt unquote. And the jury came back and said, you know, we can't come to a conclusion. Well, the judges became angry. They sent the jury back. And the jury deliberated some more and came back in and said, well, we find that William Penn, and I believe he had a co-defendant named Meade. There were two of them on trial. William Penn, of course, is the most famous. The jury came back and said, well, we find that he did, in fact, preach on the streets of London. And so the judges then were very angry. Does that mean he's guilty? And they said, well, we don't find him guilty. Well, they sent the jury back, as I recall, a third time. I'm a little bit imprecise about the details. But as I recall, the jury came back in and finally just said, no, he's not guilty. Well, what happened in the aftermath of that trial is that they locked up the jury. I mean, can you imagine this? They actually locked up the jury, and it led to another famous case called the case of Bushell. It's called Bushell's case, Edwin Bushell. And there was a habeas corpus petition that went up to a higher court, and which led to Bushell's case, and released the jurors, and it created the precedent that still is with us today, that no juror can ever be punished for his decision to acquit. And see, that's why it's so deceptive. It's really a lie for a judge to tell the jury that, you know, you must follow my instructions.
Right.
You're violating your oath as a juror if you don't follow my instructions on the law.
Well, let's adjourn on that for the moment. But we will reconvene in just a minute with Dr. Roger Roots. We're talking about the fully informed jury movement. So if you would, Your Honor, I would ask you to give us the instructions that you think every judge ought to give every jury. And then we'll talk about the implications for those instructions. And then also, since the conversation with you started because I was either tweeting back and forth or emailing back and forth with somebody about the constitutionality of police, that there's a claim that there actually is no constitutional space for a police force, which then also presents a series of problems for prosecutors. So hang on to both of those thoughts, and we'll get back to it coming up with Dr. Roger Roots. Also, if you're just tuning in the first hour, we talked about Sasquatch people with an author, and you can link up to him and grab that book at coasttocoastam.com, where you can find out more about Coast Insider and listen to every hour, anytime you want, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. It's not exactly a friend, but a good old acquaintance in Tommy Shaw and JY and the guys in Styx. I don't know if I have permission, so I can't share it with you yet, but Dean Kuntz did send a very funny email this week in regard to his mention of me and Coast to Coast on page 256 of 77 Shadow Street. I think it's the first time that Coast to Coast has gotten a nod in a Dean Kuntz novel. It's at your local bookstore. It's just been out for a couple of weeks. I think it debuted number one on the New York Times list Sunday. So today-ish, depending on where you are. And it deserves it, too. I'm really enjoying it. I'm about five chapters into it. I have actually not gotten to the point yet where I get my mention. But so far, it's a really interesting book and very different, I think, from some of the more recent Dean Kuntz novels. He's going to a different place. I asked him if he'll come on the air with us coming up on Coast to Coast, but it's, you know, it's kind of a tough slog for him. He's got a lot going on, and we may or may not get him on a second Sunday coming up sometime soon. Maybe I'll get permission to read his email, which is still cracking me up, coming up in a future show. But worth taking a look at the new Dean Kuntz novel, 77 Shadow Street, at a bookstore near you or online. And thank you, Dean, for that very kind mention. He said it was longer originally, but the editors made him take out three sentences or something. I don't know. I don't know if I can believe that, but maybe we'll get him on the air and we'll put him to the test, like we are with the fully informed jury movement. Dr. Roger Roots, criminologist and lawyer, who focuses his practice in this in our appellate system, working at a federal level, but he's watching and he's advocating for better jury instructions from judges. So what would the perfect instruction be from a judge to a jury next on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Roger Roots is very open about the ways you can contact him, and you can see that up on that webpage that we linked up at coasttocoastam.com. So the movement will grow. Thanks to your accessibility. Let me ask you about the perfect instructions, though. If you were a judge, how would you be instructing a jury to make them fully informed?
Well, it's actually very simple, really. A proper jury instruction is at the end. Keep in mind that jury instructions have all of the elements of whatever laws are at issue in the trial, you know, the first-degree murder, second-degree murder, et cetera. And by the way, the jurors, in my experience, really want to be instructed by the judge on the specific technicalities of the law. They want to know what the law is on, you know, rape or murder or assault, fraud, whatever. They really want to know. But the last instruction should always be for the judge to tell the jury, if you find that the government failed to meet its burden of proof, you must find the defendant not guilty. However, if you find that the government met its burden of proof by the burden beyond a reasonable doubt, you may find the defendant guilty. Did that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
The difference between must and may, it seems like just a minor difference, but it really is the difference between liberty and tyranny. Because in modern courtrooms, I hate to say it, this shocks a lot of people, that they're actually told they're not allowed to read the Constitution, that they're not even allowed to read the law when they serve on a jury, which is a complete violation of the fundamental intended purposes of trial by jury. Today, I mean, it sends a shiver up my spine when I hear a judge tell a jury that if you find that the government met its burden of proof, you must find the defendant guilty. That's what they actually say in some jurisdictions. And it sends a shiver right up my spine because
I get
it's absolutely
that.
Not true.
So, okay, so then what about if the jury has questions? Tell me about the fully informed jury movement in regard to a confused jury that wants to ask a question which they consider to be insightful of a defendant or of anybody who's in the witness box?
Well, you know, those questions, you know, it's funny. Those kinds of things come up from time to time. And by the way, practices vary a lot in between jurisdictions. I believe in the state of Arizona, for example, up until very recently, it was actually sort of the practice for jurors to actually ask direct questions of witnesses sometimes.
Yeah.
During trials. And by the way, in some jurisdictions over different periods of time, it has been common for jurors to issue sentences in criminal cases. And many states have had jury sentencing at different points. And of course, a lot of that has been, you know,
eliminated, right?
Eliminated.
Because of mandatory sentencing.
Well, yeah, it's a combination of things. At the federal level, the Sentencing Commission has come in with all kinds of guidelines. Judges sometimes, have a range, and really the policymakers, the legislators, and the Congress, today they generally write statutes that propose a range of penalties. So, the jurors are sort of not. It's really a scandal, in my opinion, that the jurors don't know the sentencing implications of their verdict. They really have no idea in a lot of jurisdictions. It often happens where they think a guy, they're by finding a guy guilty, that he's going to get, 6 months in jail. They find out that they gave him 10 years. And it often happens in these, what you might call three strikes kind of things, or sometimes a lot of jurisdictions have felony DUIs now, the third or fourth DUI is a felony. So the jury, they convict him of a DUI. They don't know it's his ninth DUI, and they're sending him to prison for 20 years, I mean, these kinds of things. Now, some people might look at it one way, and some people might look at it another way. I look at it like it's that the jury should be fully informed and fully knowledgeable about the sentencing implications of just what is going to happen with their verdict.
And we've seen this in a couple of interesting stories. I watch a lot of crime shows, or for that matter, news programs that often touch on this, that when jurors find out later on what the sentence was or what the implications were of their guilty verdict, they're often shocked and or they felt duped by a judge. In that they may have, for example, they may have thought somebody to be guilty, but they might have opted for a kind of jury nullification if they thought that guilty verdict was going to end up in a life sentence, which they didn't feel was a punishment that fit the crime. Does that sound familiar?
Absolutely, and it happens all the time. It's happened in some big famous cases. Happened in the Waco case. The survivors after Waco were all put on trial for, conspiring to murder federal agents and such.
Right.
And the evidence against them wasn't anything approaching that strong. There was a lot of self-defense evidence that came out. And many of them probably weren't guilty of anything. The jury, I believe, went for what they thought was the lowest level of conviction, which was what the lowest offense was, and they acquitted most of those defendants on almost everything, but then convicted them on what they thought were very minor offenses, and later found out the judge then took their conviction and sentenced those guys to, I believe, 40-year sentences and such as that. By the way, it also happened in the Wesley Snipes IRS tax evasion case more recently. I think it was just maybe 6 months ago or maybe a year ago. The Hollywood actor Wesley Snipes was put on trial for a large, just quite a series of IRS tax evasion crimes. The jury acquitted him of all of what they thought were the most severe offenses and convicted him of just three. He had failed to file three tax returns. They convicted him of three misdemeanors, essentially, failure to file three tax returns. The judge then stacked those three misdemeanor sentences on top of each other and gave Wesley Snipes the full maximum sentence on each count, three counts, and then stacked them consecutively, which of course violates, you know, the norms and all the maxims of sentencing law. Basically, the same sort of cluster of crime should generally be punished with concurrent sentencing. In other words, usually if a guy is convicted of 12 counts of a similar kind of crime, right, he will serve all of his sentences concurrently at the same time. Well, the judge, I guess to send a message about that we all have to pay our taxes, stacked those three misdemeanor sentences, 1 year sentences, times three, and gave Wesley Snipes 3 years in federal prison.
Right. You know, interesting about that, too, is, I mean, it looked like he had gotten some pretty bad advice. He may have also been flagrantly not paying his taxes, whatever. But I'm with you in the fact that that seemed to be inconsistent with the message that the jury was sending. But the judge, you know, but the jury opened the door a little bit and the judge pushed through it on that sentence. I think maybe you'll agree with this. Maybe you won't. There are times when one hears about that in regard to, say, an accused serial killer. And they'll get, you know, they'll do the consecutive life sentences with somebody that is a guarantee that they'll never be allowed to leave the prison and to commit crimes in society again. I can't think of a time when that seemed wrong to me.
Yeah, what's funny, though, is the problem is that the history of these kinds of things is so convoluted and confusing that many jurors would be, in my mind, forgiven if they were to be quite confused about what's really going to happen.
Right. That's fair enough. I just say there's certain things that seem to satisfy morally or emotionally, and when you see somebody who's given consecutive life sentences so that they can't skirt the law and get out in 15 years, you know, because of the way that the life in prison system is written, that they wouldn't be eligible for parole when they were 62, that they would just still be serving more life sentences. That doesn't seem so offensive to me as it is in a case where you mentioned three misdemeanors get stacked up to equal one felony conviction.
Yeah, I agree with you, except let me just say this. Sometimes it happens that the jurors will think, well, it happens in murder case, for example, whether, you know, they are deciding between the death penalty and what they think is life, you know, life behind bars. And
Right. One
juror will say, you know what, I've heard that life behind bars doesn't really mean life. And it actually sometimes triggers a pressure on the jury to give the death penalty, unfortunately.
Okay, fair enough.
Because they don't know, you know, and because there's been, like I said, there's just a lot of confusion about what happens. Life doesn't always mean life, as you just
pointed out. Right. And you know, again, I'm not trying to be definitive on that, but I'm just offering that as sort of a reflection on the consecutive sentence thing. Where again, we're talking about the fully informed jury movement with one of the major proponents of that, Dr. Roger Roots. You can link up to him and find out more about that by going to coasttocoastam.com. So I want to ask you about part of what started this whole conversation, which led me to you, was about seemingly... It turns out not to be true, it would seem, but seemingly the video that came out from Utica, New York, earlier in the week, showing a police officer in doing something which on the video appeared to be pulling a bag of drugs out of his back pocket and planting it inside of a vehicle using his own dashboard cam. He was recorded doing this, and then minutes later pulls those drugs out of the van and then comes back around. Now, I've read many people who pushed back on a tweet that I had sent out about that and a conversation I'd had subsequent, saying that the larger video that wasn't being shown revealed that the police officer had taken that from this particular motorist's backpack and put it in his pocket so that it wasn't necessarily planted. Now, the rest of it I'll leave up to the courts to figure out, but that's what started this. And then somebody said to me, do you realize that there's no constitutional space for law enforcement as we have it today? And I thought, well, no way. There's got to be, of course, police departments are constitutional. But that's part of what led me in this search to you. So can you address that, the constitutionality of police protection, police prosecution, search and seizure as it exists today?
Yeah, you know, I wrote an article that was published a few years back in the Seton Hall Constitutional Law Journal called "Are Cops Constitutional? ? And, you know, if you read the Constitution very closely, read it very carefully from the beginning to the end, you will find absolutely no provisions in the Constitution that even mention policing. They don't even mention it. It's not even mentioned in the U.S. Constitution anywhere. And so if you look at back in history, well, what really were the practices when the founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, wrote up and drafted and ratified that document and the Bill of Rights? What were the practices? The truth is that there were no professional police forces anywhere in the colonies, anywhere in the fledgling United States at that time. In 1791, when the Bill of Rights was ratified, there was no such thing as a police force. The way that law was enforced was largely through volunteers, through private citizenry. And a lot of people just can't even visualize it. But the first professional police forces actually didn't start up in the United States until, I believe, about the 1830s,
right?
Probably a full generation after the founding generation. In the city of Boston, mostly, and then later in some other larger cities.
New York and stuff.
Yeah, you know, there were sheriffs. There were, you know,
right.
A county would have one sheriff, and he was sort of the executive branch of the county. And, you know, there were some law enforcement duties, and there was a law enforcement sort of role. But mostly what those sheriffs did was civil in nature rather than criminal. They executed, you know, civil judgments that were issued by the courts, for example. Very, very little was done by professional law enforcement. I shouldn't even say very little. Absolutely none. There were no professional law enforcement officers in early America.
Well, okay, I'll push you a little bit on that. As I understand it, and I could be wrong, is that there were professional police, but they weren't public. They weren't tax-supported police. They were actually private police, and the idea of having a public police force was to disempower the wealthier citizens who had kind of created their own private little fiefdoms of security, and that, say, businesses would pool together and have a security guard that was be out there and would have some sort of, you know, police power. And they realized that this was getting out of hand, and that's why they instituted a public police department. Does that sound right or wrong?
Well, it's partially right. Yeah, there were constables and things that would be paid actually through court fees, or there'd be a particular fee. Let's say it was $15 to serve some kind of a judgment or execute a judgment on property or something. And so people, you know, obviously people with the means and with a little bit more wealth could afford to hire more court process and more constables to go about and do these things. And that's true. And keep in mind that there were debtors' prisons back then, and the whole system was much different. If someone owed you money, you could actually, you know, if you paid $25 to the constable, and then, you know, you could actually initiate an arrest proceeding, and it would be civil, ironically, and you'd have the guy put in jail, in debtor's jail. So, you know, it really has changed a great deal. People, it's almost like looking at the past is a different world from what we have.
Right. Yeah, I think that's part of what I was referring to, the idea that businesses could get somebody to get thrown into a debtor's jail, and that there was a financial motive on the part of the constabulary that made that unreliable, that they would benefit personally from every arrest that was made, may have been the wrong kind of incentive. But fair enough. So I want to pursue this. It's really just got started. You know, is our police departments, as we understand them, are they even constitutional? We'll get back to that coming up just a second with Dr. Roger Roots. And on my Twitter account, DeaconPunnett, Deacon Punnett, somebody asked the question about where could they go to find a fully informed lawyer that could represent them on these rights. I'll ask that, too, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.